KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. Okay, let's find out whether this chilly morning will turn into a sunny and warm Memorial Day weekend. Thomas Giboy from ABC4 is on the line. What do we got, Thomas?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty nice this weekend, Roger, especially once we get into Sunday and Memorial Day on Monday. We just have to get through a couple of hoops before we get to that point, because as we go between today and tomorrow, we do have another storm system that's on the way coming in from the west. So while things are clear out there this morning, it is a bit on the chilly side. But thankfully, with a little bit of an uptick with a southerly flow by this afternoon, temperatures will come in close to where they should be for this time of year across the Wasatch back. We'll still be below average, but at least we'll be warmer compared to what we saw yesterday. We'll top out at 60 degrees in Park City, and we'll likely see a temperature in the middle 60s down in the Heber Valley. So after a chilly start, shouldn't feel too bad by this afternoon. Our sunny skies, though, will gradually begin to erode, and we'll start to see clouds increase once we move into the afternoon as our storm system moves in from the west. So you can expect increasing clouds through the afternoon, and by the second half of the afternoon into tonight, the chance of wet weather will be increasing. We'll be looking at roughly a 1 in 3 chance of finding a shower by this afternoon, and that chance will ramp up to around a 60 to 70% chance tonight. And with the overnight low tonight only dropping to around 40 degrees in Park City, any wet weather that we find will mainly be in the form of rain. And we'll hold on to a pretty good chance for scattered showers throughout the day on Saturday as a cold front works its way in. Thankfully, this cold front's not going to have a lot of cool air with it, but it will have the moisture. So we'll be looking at roughly a 70 to 80% chance of showers, mainly throughout the day. And that chance will finally begin to go down by tomorrow night. And with the cold front moving through, the daytime highs will ease down by about 5 degrees compared to what we get today. So we'll be in the middle 50s in Park City for an afternoon high tomorrow, while Heber will be right around 60 degrees. On Saturday night, we'll transition to mostly clear skies, the overnight lows dropping into the middle 30s. And then by Sunday, high pressure will finally build in, and we'll finally get some nice weather as we round out the Memorial Day weekend and move into next week. On Sunday, it's mostly sunny with a high of 60 degrees. We'll only drop to around 40 degrees on Sunday night under mostly clear skies. And then for Memorial Day on Monday, mostly sunny with a daytime high of 70 degrees, which is actually a little bit above average. So to honor those that have fallen, Memorial Day should be a perfect day to get outside and do that. We'll trend even warmer as we go into Tuesday and Wednesday. I think that we'll see a daytime high in the middle 70s both Tuesday and Wednesday in Park City, and actually could be around 80 degrees down in Heber with overnight lows by that point in the mid to upper 40s. On Thursday, it's probably not going to be as warm, but that daytime high still holding steady in the low to mid 70s. So if we got warmer weather that's on the way, we just have to get through a couple of those hoops, as I mentioned, between today, tonight, and tomorrow, Roger.
Okay, Thomas, thank you, and have a great holiday weekend.
Likewise.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with jazz musician Quinn Domalski about his new composition, one that's going to be premiered at an upcoming Park City High School concert. Then I'm going to be joined in the studio by Park City Mayor Nan Worrell to talk about last night's city council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by chatting with Montana Burek and Cash Mendenhall about their activity on behalf of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Stay tuned. Let's do some local news. How to have a positively amazing time at the Soldier Hollow Sheepdog Championship. As KPCW's Amber Johnson reports, every dog will have its day at the Soldier Hollow Classic Sheepdog Championship and Festival this weekend.
Some 66 dogs and 45 handlers will attempt to gather 320 sheep during the 21st annual installment of the Wasatch County event, May 24th through 27th. The first Soldier Hollow trial in 2003 has grown from its humble beginnings and attracts competitors from 19 countries with more than 13,000 annual spectators. This Memorial Day weekend invitational, one of the world's largest sheepdog competitions, will showcase the creme de la creme of sheepdogs and handlers. The competition includes 3 days of preliminary rounds, followed by the championship round on Monday. Competition manager Carol Clausen said the event is family-friendly, and there'll be food and merchandise vendors, a petting zoo, kids' games, and a raptor show.
We have a close-up herding demonstration where you can see a dog work, and a trainer talks about how we train the dogs. We also use border collies for duck herding, so we have someone doing that. We have agility, and we have some canine, some police, as well as another trainer of protection dogs and search dogs, and they do a terrific job.
It's a sport that started in the UK in the late 1800s and spread to the Americas, drawing interest from a colorful cast of characters and their canine counterparts. Event founder Mark Peterson said the dogs compete in a series of 14-minute runs, guiding a small flock of sheep across a preset course down a hillside and into a small pen at the bottom, hopefully before time runs out.
And all this while, the sheep have their own idea about what they'd like to be doing which is, of course, not what the dog wants them to do or what the handler wants them to do. It all has to be done with great concern for care for the sheep, not abusing them, not stressing them out. And there's a judge that is scoring the work based on the quality of the work, the efficiency of the work, and the care of the stock.
Peterson said the relationship between the dog and handler is fascinating. Handlers remain at the bottom of the hill and communicate through intricate whistles, but the dog is not just responding to commands, it's making its own decisions.
It's not just an obedience competition. If you ask a handler, does that dog ever disobey you up on the hillside? They'll say, well, yes, of course, because sometimes I'm wrong and I want the dog to do what's right. And so the handler is expecting the dog sometimes to overrule them, to make a decision because they're right there on the sheep, to make the right decision if the handler is wrong. And if you think about that, that's a complex thing to ask a dog to do. These dogs are among the smartest four-legged creatures in the world.
These dogs are not only smart, they're smooth. Clausen said event commentator Matthew Heimberg uses a throwback analogy to those traumatic middle school years.
So there's lots of funny things that happen, and Matt is hysterical and when he talks about what's happening with the sheep, because like one day he talked about when they meet the sheep on top, he says it's kind of like at that junior high dance where you're kind of shyly walking up to ask if you can dance, and that's exactly what happens on top.
So who will be the top dog at this dance competition? Be sure to attend the Soldier Hollow Classic Sheepdog Championship to find out. This is Amber Johnson, KPCW News.
A 100-acre solar plant in Tooele County is now providing power to Park City and Summit County. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
The Electron Solar Project is expected to generate enough clean energy to power approximately 19,700 homes each year, according to metrics provided by the EPA. The plant has 20 and 25-year power purchase agreements through Rocky Mountain Power to provide renewable energy to Park City, Summit County, Park City Mountain, Deer Valley Resort, Salt Lake City, and Utah Valley University. Electron Solar began commercial operations earlier this month. Park City Sustainability Manager Luke Carton said the 80-megawatt facility was affordable for the city due to its large size.
When you're buying renewable energy projects, kind of the bigger you get, the cheaper you get too, right? It's kind of the Costco methodology of energy.
Years in the making, Carton said the project stayed on track throughout the COVID-19 pandemic and an international trade war over solar panels. He said Park City isn't overly reliant on energy from Electron Solar. Rather, it provides more ways to use clean power.
When you think about where our power comes from, we're actually tied into a 6-state grid. It could be coming from a wind project in Wyoming. It could be coming from hydro in Washington. It's a mix.
Park City has set a goal for the whole community to run on 100% renewable energy by 2030. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The Park City High School Band Program has been an outstanding aspect of our community for a number of years. That music you just heard is played by Quinn Demolsky. He's a graduate of the program, and he's on the phone to talk about how that program influenced his career and about the new work that will be premiered by the Park City High School Band Wind Ensemble this spring. Good morning, Quinn. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So, Quinn, tell us a little bit about your background and your career as a musician so far.
Yeah, definitely. So I went through the Park City High School Band program under the direction of Chris Taylor, and I graduated in 2016. I then went on to get my undergraduate degree in jazz studies at the University of Denver. I played the saxophone. I went on after that to go move to Los Angeles and get my master's in music at the University of Southern California. And now I'm a professional composer and performer living in Los Angeles.
And what kind of, tell us a little bit about that kind of a career. How do you balance the composition and the gig performances, and do you have to do any teaching to make ends meet?
Yes, yeah. So I teach about 3 days a week, private lessons, and then I do a mixture of commissions and performances of both my own music and other people's music. It's really exciting, the different kinds of opportunities that I get to do, as opposed to having to do the same sort of job every single week. You know, every single week I get something new, and it's very exciting.
And what kind of venues are you able to play in most of the work that you do in the greater Los Angeles area?
Not always. I actually just recently flew to Denver, and I had a performance at Dazzle in downtown Denver. And that performance was with my own project. It was called the Quindamalski Nonet. And a nonet is a group of nine people. So it was a nine-piece jazz band. There was six horns and three rhythm section players. And it was my own creative project. It was really awesome.
Okay, so do you perform with the nonet sometimes? Is that something that you do regularly, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of local appearances in Los Angeles? Or is the nonet something that you just form from time to time?
It's something I form from time to time, and it's actually a pretty new project for me. Mm-hmm. We've only done that one performance, so I'm looking for venues to do it out here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But I am a large ensemble composer, so I've written a bunch of big band music before, though big band isn't the most sustainable kind of music to write because you have to get a lot of people in the same room in order to do it.
Yeah, and imagine it's expensive to field, too. I mean, you got that many musicians that have all got to be paid and transported.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
I hope you're also looking for venues here in the greater Park City area.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the band program, because how important was the Park City High School band program in your development?
It was definitely very, very important. The stuff that I learned from that band program have set me up for a career of success. Chris Taylor is an amazing educator, and he really inspired me. I knew after I had graduated high school that there was nothing I could do other than music.
Now, do you
only amazing things about that program.
And do you keep up with any of the other sort of musicians that you went to high school with? Do you know of others who have gone on to professional careers?
Well, my brother is a great example. Derek Tomolsky recently changed his name to Derek Lightning. He has gone on. He also lives in Los Angeles, but he's gone on to have a pretty successful career as a musician as well. I have other friends that also went to my undergrad who have become musicians who graduated from Park City High. There's a lot of people who come out of that program and become musicians professionally, and it's awesome.
And is Derek also a jazz musician?
Yeah, he is.
Okay, do you guys ever play together?
Yeah, all the time. He plays with my quintet out here.
And correct me if I'm wrong, is your father also the bass player in the Park City Follies year after year?
Yeah, he is.
So the Domalskis are
a musician.
Yeah, the Domalskis are a family dynasty. Do the three of you ever play together?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, sometimes my brother and I will come back to Park City and we'll play some gigs. And it's awesome.
Okay, so the real reason for this conversation is that you have got a new composition that's going to be presented at a concert. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Park City High School Wind Ensemble, next Wednesday, the 29th, at 6:30 at the Eccles Center, they will be playing my new original work called Hora Somni, which translates in Latin to at the time of sleep. So they're going to be playing this piece. It's a work for wind ensemble, which means that there's going to be like 30, 40 people playing at the same time. And I'm going to be making a guest appearance conducting the piece. I'm very excited about it.
I'm visualizing the complexity as I'm sitting here listening to you talking about a 30-piece ensemble. The complexity of writing a score, do you actually individually have to write all those parts?
Yeah, I do, but there's techniques that we can do to make it a lot easier. One of them is maybe writing the piece on piano before expanding it into such a large ensemble like that. So that would be like writing it on two staves instead of 30, and then later deciding which notes go where. And there's sort of a craft to the arranging part of it. And so arranging is a word I would use to describe the part where you're deciding where the like who plays what, mm-hmm. As opposed to composing, which is where you come up with the music. That's more of an art.
Okay, that's fascinating. So you distinguish between an art and a craft there. So how long does it take to go from, let's assume you have your melodies down, the nature of the piece, the sort of structure and the flow. How long does it take you to go from that to that arranging piece?
I think it depends. Pieces for me can take anywhere from a couple weeks to like a couple months. I think it usually depends on maybe like the difficulty of the piece, the mm-hmm. length, and like the style. If it's a style that I'm less familiar with, I have to usually do a little bit more research and listening and study. But it really depends for composition. Now, the arranging side of it, because like I said, it's a craft, and I think it can be learned more easily than composition. Mm-hmm. That usually comes quicker, and I can arrange pretty quickly. So a wind ensemble piece maybe takes a week or two to arrange.
And I'm thinking about, your work week. Okay, so you're going to teach 2 or 3 days a week. You're going to do gigs. How much time in the week do you actually try to dedicate to pure composition?
I would say that also fluctuates, but I try to maybe have at least a couple hours a day of just focusing on composition. Of course, I have to balance it with practicing saxophone and piano, and then the teaching as well. But yeah, I'd say solid. Try and do it about 2 hours a day.
And how do you market your teaching? How do you get students?
Well, I actually teach at a couple studios out here in Los Angeles. So the marketing part for students isn't super difficult for me. Mm-hmm. I would say what I work on is trying to get my music out there, both get people to listen to it and also try and get people to play it.
Well, we played a snippet of your music. Let's talk a little bit about how people can find your music and what's available for them to listen to.
Yeah, definitely. So I have a big band album that's been released on streaming. It's called Quinny D Big Band 1, and you can hear it on every streaming platform, Spotify, Apple Music, all that. I also did a video recording of the session. So there's pretty high quality videos up on my YouTube channel of that recording session. And then I also recently released a single called Freak Fate. And that one is an 8-piece ensemble. It has a vocalist, soprano sax, trombone, barry sax, piano, bass, and drums. It has lyrics written by my friend Ruby Puccillo. And yeah.
Okay, so, and again, you can find those by searching Quinn Dymalski, Dymalski, on your streaming service. That you also have your own website, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, you can find all that information on my website, just quinndymalski.com.
Now, we played a snippet of that last piece as we were coming in. If we can figure out how to get the rights between now and the 9 o'clock hour, we will try to play that during our music hour following this broadcast, Quinn. Okay, Quinn, once again, the details for the upcoming concert.
Yes, so the Park City High School Wind Ensemble will be playing my piece next Wednesday, the 29th, at 6:30 at the Echo Center in Park City.
Okay, and you will be guest conducting.
Yes.
Quinn Dymalski, thanks for sharing a little bit about your fascinating career, and I'm sure people will be looking forward to that concert next Wednesday.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this. A Park City High School Latinos in Action student recently won a big scholarship at the organization's regional conference. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on one student's story.
Latinos in Action is a national group meant to empower Latino youth and prepare them for college and careers. LIA programs are year-long elective courses at the middle school, junior high, or high school level. The program also hosts conferences with workshops and competitions. At this year's LIA Conference for Central and Northern Utah, Park City High School LIA advisor Jake Jobe said students received multiple scholarships and awards.
It was probably like the most successful year we've ever had at the conference.
Park City High School LIA President Jessica Loya won the writing competition and got the top scholarship award at the conference. Both of her essays followed the conference's theme, Stronger Together. For her scholarship essay, Loya wrote about how her cultural values have influenced who she is as a student and person and the value of the LIA program.
I looked up to peers when I was younger and they tutored us at elementary level, and now at the high school level, I'm one of the tutors.
Loya said she has enjoyed being part of LAA because it opens doors to different opportunities, like the conference, and allows students to be surrounded by others with similar backgrounds and goals. However, Loya said LIA also taught her how to be a leader. In her essay, she wrote about participating in district board meetings to help adopt an equity policy and going to the Park City Council to advocate for affordable housing. For the writing competition, Loya wrote about how unifying language can be.
So I wrote about Spanish and how it's my first language, yet sometimes I felt like my English dominance or fluency was greater.
In the essay, Loya wrote her dad once said to her Mormon missionaries speak better Spanish than her. She was embarrassed, but Loya said it was true and many Hispanic kids have heard something similar. The comment pushed her to work on her Spanish and she became an LIA tutor. With progress, she connected the language with film, music, food, art, traditions, and culture. At the end of the writing competition essay, Loya wrote there are 486 million Spanish speakers in this world and they are all stronger together. Loya will be attending the University of Utah this fall. While she's unsure what career path she wants to pursue, she wrote in her scholarship essay she does know who she wants to be. A good daughter who can share new experiences with her parents, a good sister who can guide her little sister through challenges her parents are unfamiliar with and can support her older brother toward a lifestyle he can thrive in, and a good student who seeks learning opportunities outside the classroom. Loya also wrote she wants to be financially independent to support her family and give back to her community. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council held its regular meeting last night, and I understand it was a rather long one. Here to tell us some of the things that happened is Mayor Nan Wong. Good morning, Nan.
Good morning.
So, Dan, let's start with the public service contract issue. I understand that there's some discussion of a new nonprofit services advisory committee and some other changes.
There are. We've done special service contracts for years, and we've been making tweaks to it, but it never seemed to really work. So Councilmember Tolley and I have been working with staff for probably the last 6 months trying to find a more equitable, transparent way that we can administer these. And this is for services that the city either would have to provide themselves or they align with council goals. And so, for example, we've changed some of the procurement of how we will get these contracts. And Mountain Trails is a great example because they groom all of our trails. And if they weren't there to do that for us, we'd have to add that department. So it's much more cost efficient for everyone to have Mountain Trails out there. And they're such a great partner of the city.
And so about how many of these do you have a year? And how will the structure be changed under the new plan?
Some of the contracts are for 2 years and some are for 4 years, which gets kind of confusing of when the deadline is or when there isn't a deadline. And so we're trying to make several of them a four-year contract instead of having to come back in every 2 years. You know, I sat on the nonprofit side when I ran one for several years, and so I'm well familiar with both sides of the process of applying and the stability that it gives nonprofits to know that they have a four-year contract. We also wanted to increase the transparency of the process, and so we're going to form a new city board that will interview all of the candidates, all of the people that have submitted for a special service contract, now called a public service contract, and make recommendations to the council. So the council still has the final decision making, but they will, you know, solicit the applications, review the applications, interview the nonprofits, and then make recommendations. So it's all in a public meeting. The Public Meeting Act will apply to these.
Are some of these actually competitive, where you have more than one not-for-profit seeking to do a similar task?
Yeah, and that was part of the problem, is we had some that were a bit overlapping and duplicative. So I'm really excited about this new process. I think that it will let the public see exactly how their dollars are being spent.
And do you anticipate that there will be some sort of enhanced definition of what the city's looking for, kind of like more formal, not quite a formal RFP, but something close to that, so that there is definition given to the not-for-profits as to what you want?
Yeah, I think there will be. And again, that's been a frustration of some of the nonprofits. And having sat on that side, it's sometimes you're kind of guessing at what it is exactly that your people are looking for. So I'm excited about this process.
Okay. And when will that, when will the nuts and bolts be hammered out and the definitive plan sort of be rolled out for this?
They're going to be coming back to the council in the near future mm-hmm. with an idea of how we can stand this group up and, you know, how it'll be governed, how many people will be on it. So, you know, it's a big deal to establish one of these boards.
And this will be citizens. In other words, it's going to be staffed by, I assume people will volunteer and you'll do a selection mm-hmm. process.
Just like all any of our other boards.
Right, exactly, uh-huh. like any other board. Okay, anything else on that?
No.
Okay, moving on. I understand you saw presentations from both Park City and Deer Valley. What are some of the highlights that our audience should hear about?
Both of them had great seasons. They got off to a bit of a slow start with the snow. And February, wow, did we catch up in the month of February. So they ended up both with great seasons. It was the 60th anniversary for Park City Mountain. And so they had all sorts of celebrations that went along with that. Deer Valley had a great season as well. And they, you know, over the last year, I think it was 9 months ago, they announced their expanded terrain, and so they've been, you know, working hard on getting the other part of that, the east side of that terrain open for next year. They've already done some ski touring over there.
Now, the question for you, if part of that other side is going to be, that's in Wasatch County, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, so will there have a sort of a tax implication of the fact that they'll be selling lift tickets in two places?
You know, that's still being worked out. We have a similar situation with the canyons in
right.
Park City Mountain.
Although with the canyons, it's Summit County, and that's why another layer of complexity, I assume.
It is,
which,
yeah.
Which I assume you have a little bit of time to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
The council received an update on the Bonanza Park 5-acre project. Where do things stand now?
They're moving along, and I know people always laugh when I say that we really are moving along. We are going out this week, I believe, the 29th, with our request for qualifications so that we can kind of pre-qualify developers that want to work with us on that 5-acre parcel. And then from that, the council will be meeting in a special session on June 5th, and again our regular meeting on June 6th, so it's going to be a heavy week for the council. And we're going to be answering the questions that we're going to have answers to as we go out with the RFP. Such as who's going to remediate the soil, who's going to build the parking, who's going to build the housing, and those type of things.
Okay, just for, as an old procurement lawyer, I think I understand the distinction. The first thing you're going to do is send out something where you're asking for qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a defined group of potential bidders, then you will proceed to the stage where you put out an RFP, which is, this is exactly what we want you to propose to. This is the scope of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And again, moving along, I know there's a lot of frustration in the community about how long this has taken. What's your latest crystal ball estimate of when there will be sort of a defined project and an awarded contract?
Probably within 6 to 8 months.
Which is actually, okay, that's pretty ambitious.
It is ambitious. And I think what's important is that the small area plan draft is finished for the entire Bonanza Park area. And that went to our planning commission this week on mm-hmm. Wednesday night. And that was the first time the public weighed in on the small area plan that has come together. So we're moving along. And another thing we talked about last night was undergrounding the power lines that run over the 5-acre parcel. And that's critical that we get that done, because otherwise we lose about an acre by the time the power lines run and the easements you have to have on both sides of those, that you really can't build much underneath. So it's just going to free up a lot on that parcel. So Rocky Mountain Power has done a study of how much it will cost, and it's probably going to be around $7 million to get those undergrounded. It's a lengthy process. We're going to get going with it, but they have to do some preliminary design work, and that's going to take 8 to 10 weeks, and then they have to do engineering drawings, which is another 6 to 8 weeks. And then the biggest part is that ordering the cable. So once they figure out how much cable they need and get it ordered, then it's still another 46 to 52 weeks before we can actually get it in there. The good news is that we can go ahead this summer, hopefully, and lay the conduit for it, so that we've got it underground, and when the cable finally gets here, we just thread it. We're going to have to go under Kearns to do that. The best time to do that is going to be fall, according to Rocky Mountain Power.
Of course, I would have assumed that you could just take the lines that are up in the air and stick them in the ground, but it doesn't work that way.
Apparently not. But one thing that I'm excited about is that by rerouting these and undergrounding the lines, we're going to free up 70 plots in the cemetery. Because right now there's power lines that go over the cemetery, and as most people know, we don't have any space left. And so by adding another 70 plots, lots is going to be a big bonus for the community.
That's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought that power lines would interfere with your ability to dig a hole underneath them, but apparently that's a problem. So let's see, the $7 million, does Rocky Mountain bear any of those costs, or is that all on the city?
You know, we talked about that last night. They're doing, some final tweaking of the costs and what do we get credit for.
Right.
You know, they're not going to have to put in 12 poles that they otherwise would have as they're doing their wildfire, mitigation. And, there's some other things, the other expenses they're not going to have to incur. So, we're working with them on figuring out what the bottom line is going to be.
Okay. So that, again, as you said, that hopefully you could start with the burying as early as this summer.
Yeah. So we could, once we're ready to get a shovel in the ground, we don't have to worry about getting those power lines out of the way.
Okay. It seems like you can't have a council meeting without talking about either housing, e-bikes, or pickleball. Which the three came up last night?
E-bikes. But you're exactly right. You are so right. So we, our trails and open space team and our other folks have been working really, really hard on our e-bike ordinance. And does it still stand? They did a study or survey with Basin Rec and got a lot of feedback from the community. I believe over 2,000 responses. So last night we saw it broken down by groups that own a mountain bike, groups electric mountain bike, groups that own an electric bike, and other groups that don't own either one. And, so it was interesting to see, not surprising, to see the responses and the differences between the groups. So one of the questions that the council was asked was about speed limit on paved trails, because there's a lot of concern, especially from people that are walking or strolling their babies or whatever, with e-bikes zipping past them at really high speeds. So the council did agree on a 15-mile-an-hour speed limit on paved trails on electric bikes.
And again, you know, particularly in the summertime and the Summit County, bike shares, you'll see young kids without helmets. And I realize that helmets are not something that you can address. As I understand, that's a state regulation.
Well, we directed staff to look at what can we do with helmet regulations.
Can you do helmets
here
on your own paths? That's what I don't know about.
So that's what we're having everybody look into and see legally what can we do. We're very concerned about health and safety and kids, as you say, riding bikes at high speeds without,
And you see that a lot in the summer. Of course, when you talk about adding a speed limit, the next logical question is the complexities of enforcement.
Exactly.
What are you thinking about there?
I think that we're going to start with just a lot of increased signage, making people aware that there is a speed limit. And then we'll take it from there. But that's going to be the first step. Education is going to be a big part of how we go forward with this. Increased signage showing who has right-of-way on trails.
I wonder if the Summit County rideshare bikes could put in a governor so they wouldn't go faster than 15 miles an hour.
That's a suggestion.
It's interesting. There's an award-winning economist called Richard Thaler who has written about the concept of nudge. And nudge is when you put something up like a speed limit, whether or not you've got armed officers, pulling kids over. The reality is that sign in and of itself will change behavior, sort of like the animal signs that you see on 224.
One thing I learned through this whole process is that in the state of Utah, it's illegal for anyone under 14 to be on an e-bike without the parent in direct supervision.
Wow. Will the speed limit also apply to non-electric bikes?
Great question. I know that came up. I don't remember what the answer was.
Okay.
There is concern about that.
Okay. I want to touch on a couple things we're out of time. One is, I understand there was a discussion about water rates, and this is the victim of your own success problem, isn't it?
It is. We've had a tremendous amount of cash outlay recently, and that was partly due to the building of our new water treatment plant that we're going to cut the ribbon on June 24th. I'm so excited to have that happen. And it also, is a factor of our aging infrastructure. Who would have thought 2 years ago that we were going to have to spend $10 million to replace the water infrastructure under Main Street? We've got the main line laid right now. We're doing the laterals that go into the buildings. And then I think the third reason is, and this sounds so counterintuitive, but conservation. Our residents have really stepped up and are saving water and, turning off those taps and watching how much they irrigate. But by conserving water, our revenues have gone down. So we looked at, we hired an outside group to do a study of our water rates and our water system and what revenues we're going to need going forward. So the council was given four options of a rate increase. The consultant recommended a 10% rate increase, and all of us just weren't quite comfortable doing that. And so what we finally, we took the third option, which increases the rates 4.5% for the next 4 years. And then one thing that we have not been doing is charging city-owned facilities for water use, like golf hasn't been charged. And so they're an enterprise fund just as water is. And so we're going to start charging those funds for the water that they use. And we're trying to figure out now what rate that will go at. You know, do we charge them the same as everybody else, or do we have a municipal rate? So all of those things have to be worked out. Another part that will go into this is our water department applied for a federal earmark of $5 million to help with the Main Street Water Project. I got a call from Representative John Curtis, interested in knowing more about what the project was. He's awesome because he's been a mayor and he knows what it's like to have to add infrastructure that you weren't expecting to have to add. So we have cleared the first hurdle and he has forwarded a request for a $5 million earmark for us.
I'm thinking about the complexities. You just recently went through a process of determining what the rates for golf would be. And if you're going to turn around and then start laying another expense on the golf course, which as we all know uses a lot of water,
right?
You know, that will sort of create an issue about maybe that's pushed into the next year about, you know, how much you're going to be charging for golf.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Nothing's all that simple, Nan.
I wish. I wish we could just get one thing that's simple.
Before we go, Nan, talk to us. Can you share with us a little bit about the city's attitude about the potential Sundance move? We saw that the city, that this area, or Utah, had cleared the first stage in that process. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any publicity about who the other cities that cleared that first stage is, which I think is fascinating. Have they not? Have you seen anything that reveals the other competitors at this point?
Sundance is not going to release that information.
Interesting procurement approach by Sundance. So, what efforts are being undertaken, and you know, what is the city's attitude about the desire to keep it?
We would love to keep Sundance here. We've heard from lots of residents, and especially businesses and film fans, about the importance of keeping it here in Utah. We're working very closely with jurisdictions down in the Wasatch Front, and we're moving forward.
Okay. It's interesting that Utah came out with a press release saying, we've cleared the first hurdle, we're in it. Haven't seen anybody else do that. It's fascinating to me that the other competitors, whoever they may be, haven't chosen to step forward and identify themselves. I wonder why that is.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay. And with that, Mayor Nan Worrell, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
Okay.
Utah Valley University is helping high school students in the Wasatch Back get college credit. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the university is also connecting with locals through the satellite campus in Heber.
UVU has the largest student population in the state with over 43,000 students enrolled. Wasatch Area Director Becca Grulich said that's because the Orem campus is full and the school offers concurrent enrollment classes so high school students can get college credit. Both Park City High School and Wasatch High School have high enrollment numbers in UVU CE classes, which are very affordable. Each credit costs $5, so a regular three-credit class is only $15, Grulich said on a recent visit to KPCW's local news hour.
We are having some graduates at both of those high schools graduating almost with an associate's degree, which puts them entering the university as a sophomore, which decreases the number of years that they actually need to be attending the university.
The college also has a Wasatch campus in Heber. The campus hosts core classes as well as a specialized program called the Wasatch Resort Management, or WARM, program. WARM allows students to receive a bachelor's degree in hospitality management in 5 semesters. Grulich said the program is a way UVU can support economic development in the Wasatch Back. During the program, she said students get hands-on experience at resorts in Park City, including the St. Regis, the Montage, and Blue Sky. She said UVU is also changing its offerings at the Wasatch campus to accommodate adult learners so they can earn degrees.
Heber recently did a demographic study that 35% of their population has some college, no degree. So we're changing our offerings and offering more of our general education classes on the block, trying to appeal to those adult learners who are looking to come back and finish their degree.
Grulich said having a satellite campus in Heber also allows UVU to connect with the community, even if students aren't aiming to get a degree.
We have a really vibrant community education program that is open to all the residents of the Wasatch BAC. And we have some unique classes that are only available on our Heber campus.
The program has classes to learn horseback riding, fly fishing, mahjong, and Grulich said this semester UVU is partnering with the Park City Business to offer glass blowing. Find a link to learn more about UVU Wasatch campus offerings at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
A 30-year-old Salt Lake City man died after crashing a personal watercraft in East Canyon State Park Wednesday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports authorities are reiterating the importance of life jackets and helmets ahead of the Memorial Day weekend.
Utah State Parks says Benjamin Paul Rosser, a Salt Lake resident originally from Pennsylvania, crashed into a rock face on the reservoir's west side. According to a Parks Division press release, a nearby fisherman who heard the crash and saw its wreckage called authorities around 7:30 p.m. Wednesday. Rangers responded on a patrol boat, but Rosser succumbed to his injuries and died as they attempted to rescue him. The Morgan County Sheriff's Office and EMS assisted. Park rangers said Rosser was wearing a life jacket. With the Memorial Day holiday just days away, parks officials say people should always recreate with a buddy and remember to wear or pack the right gear for activities, including life jackets and helmets. The agency also recommends being weather aware and says it's important to let loved ones know where you're headed and when you expect to return. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
A driver was injured in a crash at the intersection of U.S. 40 and U.S. 189 in Heber City Thursday morning. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
The crash occurred around 9 a.m. Thursday when a driver attempted to turn left from Main Street onto 1200 South. Heber City Police Sergeant Josh Weishar says the car was hit by a semi-truck.
And the semi T-boned that small sedan and caused injuries to the driver, and he was transported to the hospital.
Weishar says the extent of the sedan driver's injuries are unknown, but the person was conscious when paramedics responded. The car was a total loss. The truck driver was uninjured. Weishar says the crash was likely caused by distracted driving. He says crashes are frequent at the intersection, especially with left turns.
Accidents happen, but you just got to use wise judgment when you're driving in that intersection.
Traffic was disrupted after the crash for about an hour while first responders cleared the scene. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
I am now joined on the phone by Montana Burak and possibly Cash Mendenhall with the Citizens Climate Lobby. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Okay, who do I have on? Do I have both of you, or is it just Montana?
Montana's on.
Okay, Montana, thanks for being here. Montana, what is the Citizens Climate Lobby, and how did you come to get involved?
Yeah, so the Citizens Climate Lobby is an international organization of a variety of chapters worldwide, kind of fighting for climate advocacy. Most of the chapters are located here in the United States, and we have several here in Utah as well. And it's a bipartisan organization that unites to basically lobby for climate policy in Washington, D.C. So it's an awesome organization. I came about it when I was just starting high school. I had a friend involved in it, and they got me involved in it. And I've been there ever since. They do some awesome work here with the Citizens Climate Lobby.
And Montana, I take it that you actually went on a trip last year to Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I did.
Okay, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Citizens Climate Lobby, every June they have a nationwide lobby day where people from the Citizens Climate Lobby across the entire country all go out to D.C. and lobby their representatives. So I had the opportunity to go on that to the lobby day and lobby my representatives in D.C. And as a part of that, there's a lot of learning that happens. They have a conference where they teach you how to lobby your representatives and kind of advocate better for change in Washington, D.C., and at home in your various states the members are part of throughout the country. So that was an awesome opportunity. I learned a ton about politics and had the opportunity to make at least a little bit of a difference. So.
And how many congresspeople did you actually get to meet with? And then how many staffs?
Yeah, so when I was in D.C., we met with a staffer for Representative Blake Moore. some other individuals meet with other representatives as well. So you kind of have a lobby team where you go and lobby a specific representative. And they teach you everything at the lobby conference. So you need no experience to lobby. So it's really great experience. Even if you don't meet a ton of representatives, you learn so much about politics regardless.
And what specific kinds of legislation were you trying to lobby for last year?
There was a variety of them. I know there was like a bill about wildfires. There was the farm bill of some sort that you're trying to get passed. And there was some other legislation that we talked about as well. I'm not sure the exact policies they're lobbying for this year, but there's always policies that have more bipartisan support, that focus on climate and the environment. And they're always well thought out policies that they educate you a ton on when you go to D.C. to lobby.
Now, have you seen any results? Has any of the kinds of issues that you advocated for last year, has any of that been enacted into law?
Yeah, I believe so. I think the farm bill we advocated for ended up getting passed with like a huge margin of success across the party support. And I know a lot of what the Citizens Climate Lobby also is trying to aim for is also like long-term relationships. So here in Utah, we have a lot of Republican legislatures who are pretty into environmental legislation, and the Citizens Climate Lobby is really big into creating these long-term relationships with them. People in our chapter have known several representatives from Utah for several years and have been able to effectively lobby them for change. So that's also a big part of what they do in meeting these representatives in D.C. and getting to know them over time. So,
now, Montana, you're graduating, as I understand it. How has your experience with the Citizens Climate Lobby affected your future plans? Is it affecting what you want to major in or a potential career?
Yeah, totally. So I'm interested in going into environmental science, and that's what I'm majoring in college. And I'm definitely interested in like the policy aspect of that. I wasn't always interested in that specific field of environmental science. And the Citizens Climate Lobby and the work that I've been able to do through them has definitely inspired me to make some changes in my life and pursue it as a career. But even the Citizens Climate Lobby also does a good job of engaging people of all ages. And if you're interested in volunteering, there's something for everyone. You don't have to lobby in D.C., but if you do want to lobby, there's a lot of opportunities to do that. But they also put on a lot of community events to educate the public on environmental issues and get to know some of their local politicians who are running for local offices. So highly encourage anyone of any age to get involved if they're interested in helping the environment.
Okay, Montana, and just so our listeners know, where are you going to go to school?
I'm going to Oregon State University next year.
All right. Okay, looking forward to a career in Corvallis. Thanks very much for spending time with us this morning. We'll be right back after this. Park City Film will round its regular season offerings with three more films in the coming weeks. KPCW's Sydney Weaver has more on these must-see films and an upcoming film festival.
For those still hanging around town this Memorial Day weekend and in need of a laugh, Park City Film will screen the coming-of-age dramedy, Uproar. The film, directed by Taika Waititi, follows a mixed-race teenager in New Zealand who's learning to find his voice and stand up for himself and his family. Uproar will run Friday and Saturday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 6. It is followed next week by Luca Guadagnino's Challengers, which runs May 31st through June 2nd. Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang said the final film of the year is one outdoor enthusiasts can't miss.
We are closing things out for the season with one of my favorite directors, the award-winning director of Drive My Car, and Hamaguchi's new film is called Evil Does Not Exist. And this is a film that focuses on a remote Japanese hamlet that faces an existential crisis when a developer plans to build a glamping site nearby.
The final film runs June 7th through the 9th. Wang explains film lovers won't have to wait long for more cinematic treasures. On June 6th, Park City Film will roll out a special film festival to kick off the summer season.
We are doing a Studio Ghibli Film Festival this year. So for the uninitiated, if you are familiar with Japanese anime, the auteur of that medium is Hayao Miyazaki. He is second to none. Studio Ghibli is the studio that he formed. So we'll be showcasing a series of his films, seven of his films, across the course of the summer.
The Studio Ghibli series kicks off with the 1997 film Princess Mononoke. For a full lineup and to purchase tickets, visit kpcw.org. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
So let's figure out what's going on Monday for Memorial Day. Saturday is the final day to stock up at the liquor store before Memorial Day, when all stores will be closed. Wouldn't be surprised to see some lines. U.S. post offices are also closed, and UPS pickups and delivery will be postponed till Tuesday. These are all closed on Monday, Memorial Day. City and county government offices in the Wasatch Back will be closed Monday, March 27th, as will area Department of Motor Vehicle locations. Park City, Summit, and Wasatch County libraries will also be closed in observance of the holidays. But in Summit County, Republic Services will still pick up the trash on Monday. Wasatch County trash pickup will be delayed until Tuesday.